Candy from Strangers by Mark Coggins is original, smart, and good to the last page, says best-selling author and executive producer of the hit TV series Bosch, Michael Connelly. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 3. It Takes One to Know One. There was no red in the sky the following morning, just a lot of gray. I'd put in a few sleepless hours of mattress time and was now heading downtown along Post Street for my apartment on Hyde. It was about 9:30. The fog still hung heavy in the air and was thick enough that it fooled a handful of seagulls into flying inland the 3+ miles from the bay. They were gliding in a corkscrew pattern well above the sidewalk when one of them gave a shrill cry, broke formation, and tried to dive-bob me from 12 o'clock high. But unlike Jack Kittredge, the seagull missed. To avoid further terror from the sky, I made a mad dash across the street to the haven of Saeed Al-Sarraf's corner grocery. Wearing his usual black beret and olive-green sweater, Saeed looked like a Republican Guard commander from the last war, but he was actually a former college professor who'd gotten fed up with the lazy, ill-prepared graduate students who populated his 19th-century literature classes. If I had to grade one more paper with improper or missing footnotes, he told me, I would have slit my throat and scratched out the corrections in my own blood. I'd rather hawk greasy donuts and bad coffee. I purchased two of the former and a large cup of the latter, and continued down Post. Grease from the donuts had spotted the bag by the time I turned right onto Powell, and by the time I reached Market, the spot had grown to a translucent stain the size and shape of the Indian subcontinent. I shouldered my way through the line of tourists at the cable car turnaround, slopping some of the bad coffee on a middle-aged guy wearing a Fisherman's Wharf t-shirt with the tagline, "Got Crabs," and went up to the Samuel's Jewelers street clock in front of my building to indulge in a superstitious ritual of mine. I never walked by without tapping it. The old clock had been refurbished recently, and the new blue and gold paint on it shone brightly. But just then an emaciated character in army fatigues and a sweatshirt with cut-off sleeves was slumped against it. He had a wispy black mustache that stuck out like cat's whiskers, and from beneath a stocking cap that looked like the reservoir tip of a Trojan condom, a wash of lank, badly dyed blonde hair flowed to his shoulders. When I reached around him to tap the clock, he fixed me with a glazed look and said, "Want to buy some dope, man?" I grinned and shook my head. "No, thanks. I get mine from 1-800-PET-MEDS. I covered the distance to the cavernous entryway of the flood building before he managed to shout, "Does that really work, man?" My rooms were on the 12th floor and came fully equipped with pebble glass windows, superannuated potted plants, and two office mates, both of whom were there. Ben Bonnaker, an insurance salesman with the biggest cap teeth this side of the Mississippi and the worst jokes on either side, was standing by the fax machine with an exasperated expression on his face. He was dressed in his interpretation of business casual, a golf shirt with the logo of his insurance company on the breast pocket, and a pair of the always fashionable Sansabelt slacks. I gestured at his considerable waistline. "You missed a loop there." He reached instinctively for his belt line, then stopped short. "Very nice. Kick a man when he's down. Can't you see I'm in crisis mode here?" "What's the problem?" "I've got to get this quote to a client by 10, but every time I fax it, it comes back blank on the other side." I set my coffee on the table next to the fax machine and grabbed the stack of papers in the exit tray. I flipped them face up and plunked them back into the feeder tray. "Pages go face up. See the little icon with a writing on top?" Bonnaker stared at the icon for a long moment, the air in his nose making a whistling noise as he breathed. "Oh yeah, I was just going to try that." I gave a curt nod, picked up my coffee, and headed back to my office. Gretchen Sabatini, my second office mate, part-time secretary, and one-time fiancé was standing in the hallway with a smirk on her face. "I do love a man who's handy around the workplace," she said. Gretchen was wearing black, like always. Business casual to her was a slim-cut pantsuit with a silver zipper down the middle and double darts in front that cinched the fabric of the jacket tight around her improbably narrow waist. She finished the ensemble with black Italian boots and a black ribbon choker with an antique cameo that I had given her when we were still engaged. I looked her up and down from her luxuriant auburn locks to the toes of her pointy boots and smacked my lips. "You look good enough to marry." She smirked some more. "Too late for you, Buster. You missed your chance." "Then you leave me no choice but to seek solace with these donuts in my lonely office." I elbowed on the light switch as I entered and plunked myself in the decrepit wooden swivel chair behind the desk. It squeaked like a weasel in electroshock therapy. Gretchen appeared in the doorway. "Still, I do like the choker." I pushed the detritus of my private detective business from my desk blotter to make room for the donuts and then tore open the bag. "That's nice," I said between bites. A wistful statement of regret would have been nicer. "I do like the choker." I sighed, wistfully. "I guess that's to be expected since you picked it out. Something about not liking the turquoise bolo tie I originally selected. Now why didn't you help Boniker with the facts? He can barely work the elevator, for Christ's sakes." Gretchen advanced to a spot in front of my desk. "I'm on strike." "Why?" "Because he told one of those awful jokes of his to my boyfriend when he came by for lunch yesterday." I paused in my annihilation of the first donut. This was going to be good. "You mean your boyfriend, the urologist?" Gretchen frowned and picked up one of the many half-empty paper cups that littered my desk. She held it under my nose so that I could see the island of green mold floating in a black sea of coffee sludge. "When are you going to mow the lawn?" she snapped. "Of course that's who I mean. And no more of your snide comments about his chosen profession. Thank you very much." I popped the last piece of the donut in my mouth and made a zip my lips gesture while I chewed. "What's the joke then?" I asked finally. "I'm not going to repeat it. Let's just say that Dennis was very offended and..." Boniker must have been listening in the other office because he chose that exact moment to stick his head through the door. "By the way, August, what did the urologist's vanity plate say?" "I don't know, Ben," I said, not believing I was actually encouraging him. "What did it say?"
"The number 2, the letter P, the letter C, and the word me. 2P, see me."
I forced a belly laugh, not because I found the joke funny, but because I wanted to needle Gretchen. She didn't needle very well. She grabbed a ruler from the desk and whacked it near the blotter, making the pieces of donut glazing jump like trained fleas. "That's it. It's a general strike now. I'm not lifting a finger to help either of you." Boniker gave me a broad wink and disappeared from the doorway. I looked back at Gretchen and found her glaring down at me, still holding the ruler in a threatening manner. "I believe you said something about a lonely office. Let me oblige you." She chucked the ruler on the desk and charged out of the room, pulling the door closed hard enough to make the pebble glass rattle. After mistakenly grabbing a cup full of mold from earlier in the week, I sipped some of today's coffee and then worked hard on finding solace with a second donut. I was down to crumbs of comfort with the glazing chips when a timid knock sounded at the door. If my "come in" sounded a little smug, it was only because I was expecting a contrite Gretchen returning to apologize. What I got instead was a not-so-contrite Chris Duckworth. The mermaid outfit had been replaced by jeans and a colorful sort of half-blouse, half-smock that grave robbers must have filched from Carmen Miranda's casket. His eye, however, was still swollen shut and was now competing with the blouse for the Best Use of Discordant Colors Award, hues of green, blue, and black being the most conspicuous. "Nice to see you back in men's clothes." "Sort of," I said. Chris gave a weird, cyclops-like leer and stepped into the office. He arranged himself in his flowing blouse thing in one of the client's chairs. "You got that line from Woody Allen." I wadded up the donut bag and tossed it into the trash can. The sort of part was mine. "There's innovation," said Chris. I stood up with a squeak and took two of the paper cups from the desk to the sink at the back wall. I dumped the coffee and mold down the drain and then tossed the cups in the garbage. I was halfway through the process with the second pair when Chris spoke behind me. "Aren't you going to ask me what happened?" "Well," I said over my shoulder, "you're alive. That's the most important thing." "I'm more than alive. I'm positively teeming." I turned to look back at him. "Oh, yeah, a couple more shots like the one you took in the eye and you wouldn't be teeming. You'd be in the hospital, or worse." "You're exaggerating. I knew what I was doing." I slung the second pair of cups into the trash, splattering liquid all over the can and the floor. "Knew what you were doing," I said. "If you knew you were going to start a riot, you might have let the rest of us in on it." He put two fingertips to his damaged eye and winced. "I am sorry about that part. I didn't think that was going to happen." "Chris, when that crowd of sailors came into the room, it changed from a liberal, tolerant bar in San Francisco to a place where diversity, particularly diversity in sexual orientation, was not welcomed. Didn't you read about that kid in Wyoming that was killed? Or the transsexual in the East Bay? You can't do a gender bait and switch with those kind of guys and not expect them to be very threatened and consequently very angry." Chris looked at me soberly for a moment and then burst out laughing. It was not the reaction I had expected. "He's gay," he said finally. "He's gay." "What?" "The sailor at the bar, Hambert. He's gay." I slid into my chair. "The guy who hit you because he found out you weren't a girl is gay?" "That's right," Chris nodded eagerly. "As gay as a French horn." "When did you find out?" "I knew it as soon as I saw him. That's why I popped my falsie, to show him what was what." I slumped back into my chair to the accompaniment of a long, low creak like the opening of the door in the old Inner Sanctum radio hour. "Couldn't you have sort of pulled him over to the side during a break and given him your big news in private?" Chris looked down and rearranged the folds of his blouse. "I guess I was a little drunk. I wanted to do it with flair and panache." "Panache? Pardon my ignorance, but is panache French for bonehead?" I paused for a moment. "There's still more to this, isn't there? What happened after I left?" Chris leaned forward to put his elbows on the desk and then propped his chin on a bridge he made with his hands. He looked at me coyly. "I went back to the bar, pulled the young admiral from the wreckage, and took him straight back to my apartment to provide comfort and succor." I waved my hands in a squeamish gesture. "I don't want to hear anything about the succor part." "Why ever not, August? Can't one friend tell another about his love life? It was all very romantic. We lit candles, put on appropriate mood music. What'd you pick? Something by Enya?" Chris said, "No, we..." Then the dime dropped. "Very funny, August. There might have been more of the old Enya and Atya if you hadn't have mauled him so badly. He could barely perform." "Okay, I think that's about all this friend wants to hear about your love life. What happened this morning? Did you drive him to the docks and wave a silk handkerchief as he sailed heroically through the Golden Gate?" "Heck no. He's here for another 2 weeks. We had a wonderful breakfast at a restaurant with a patio terrace, and then he bought me this little number at a Castro boutique." Chris leaned back from the desk and held a pinch of the fabric from his blouse. "Very fetching, don't you think?" "Too bad you didn't get the matching turban covered with pineapples and pomegranates." Chris wrinkled his nose at me. "If I thought you had any fashion sense or a modicum of concern about your own appearance, I might be offended." "And if I knew what a modicum was, I might be offended." Chris stood up. "Well, a modicum of concern might be giving a damn when you're walking around with a piece of donut sticking out of your uppers." I had recently been fitted with a partial denture to replace two front teeth that had been knocked out, and I was very sensitive about it. I brought my hand up to cover my mouth. "Thanks," I mumbled. He stepped back from the chair and fluffed out his blouse. "I forgot to ask. Did you make it home okay?" I briefly considered telling him about the girl and then remembered my vow to steer clear of it. "Yeah," I said with my hand still over my mouth. "Got home fine." "Well, you've got some personal hygiene to attend to, and I need to catch a little shut-eye to make up for last night." "Wait a minute." "Yes?" "Where's the money I loaned you?" Chris gave an airy wave of the hand. "Oh, that. Well, Hambert didn't have enough cash for the top, so I had to give him your money to pay for it. He's good for it, I'm sure." "You mean I paid for that?" Chris moved to the door. "Yes, that's right. You see now why it's all the more important that you appreciate it. Cheers." He slipped through the door and was gone. I got up to look in the mirror over the sink, and sure enough, there was a chunk of donut sticking out from the denture. I pulled the plate out of my mouth and was running water over it when Gretchen barged in. "I'm still on strike, but..." She stopped short at the sight of me, turning to look at her. "That's disgusting, August. Put that thing back in. You look like the ghost of Leon Spinks." Startled and more than a little embarrassed, I hunched over the sink to return the plate to my mouth. It took a lot of fiddling to get it seated, and I felt myself getting redder and redder as I struggled. "What?" I said when I finally succeeded. "What do you want?" Gretchen held her face stiff to keep from smiling. She said, "You have a client."
You have been listening to Candy from Strangers, a book Mystery Scene Magazine described as crackling and whip smart. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.